Well, say goodbye to plastic and goodbye to cars. No more convenience stores and hello to stuff. No more Wall Street and no more Pentagon. Thinking about these things makes me happy. We're dancing on the ruins of the multinational corporation. Dancing on the ruins of the multinational corporation. Dancing on the ruins of the multinational corporations. Ha, ha, ha.
Good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for September 14th, 2018. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. The opinions expressed on Corporations and Democracy are those of our guests and the hosts and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Our guest today is one of those people who's difficult to introduce, because it could take so long to mention his background and accomplishments. Norman Solomon is a name that will be familiar to many of you, not only for having been a prolific journalist, media critic, author, and activist for several decades, but also for having been the second highest vote getter right here in Mendocino County in the June 2012 primary for the California District 1 congressional seat. But throughout the entire district, he was a close third, 1.5 percentage points behind the second-place finisher, the Republican candidate, and the winner, of course, is our current Congressman Jared Huffman. Well, Norman's dozen books over the years include War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, published in 2005, for which the Los Angeles Times reviewer referred to him as a formidable thinker and activist. A documentary based on War Made Easy was released a few years later in 2007. He also co-authored the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, along with foreign correspondent Reese Ehrlich, and that was in January of 2003, just a few months before the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. And that book has been very popular and been translated into 5 other languages. Solomon is the founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a consortium of policy researchers and analysts. He is IPA's executive director and is the coordinator of its Expose Facts program. He is a co-founder and coordinator of the online organization RootsAction.org, which now has more than 1.5 million active supporters. And he's a longtime associate of the media watch group FAIR, that's Fairness and Accurate in Accuracy in Reporting. And finally, just a few years ago, in 2015, he became a member of the Courage Foundation Advisory Board. So, everybody take a deep breath, and let's look at the Democratic Party at a crossroads again, 50 years after the infamous 1968 Chicago Convention. And we'll look at the party that's not-so-super delegates, and the politically shifting ground. Norman Solomon, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
Yeah, it's really great to have you on. You've done so much thinking about the 2016 election. It just takes my breath away. But you make a comparison between the notorious Democratic Convention in Chicago in 1968 and then a smaller convocation of Democrats 50 years later in Chicago, and that's quite so much police riots going on the outside, but something going on the inside seemed very similar to you. Do you want to compare those two events?
Well, Annie, I think that, as the saying goes, history never repeats itself, but it can tend to rhyme an awful lot. And what was the undercurrent, along with the Vietnam War, in the conflict at the Democratic Convention in 1968 is still with us, and that is a shortage of democracy inside the party. You know, Hubert Humphrey was nominated as the presidential candidate of the party in 1968 without entering any primaries at all. It was that corrupt. It was that non-democratic. And in fact, more than two-thirds of the candidates who ran were anti-war in the primaries that did exist at the time for the presidential nomination. But, of course, Hubert Humphrey was very pro-war. So fast forward to a couple of years ago, and, of course, in our congressional district, Bernie Sanders got more votes in the primary here a couple of years ago than Hillary Clinton. But the superdelegate from this district, the Congressman Jared Huffman, actually voted in the convention for Hillary Clinton to get the nomination. And that is symptomatic of what's wrong with, has been wrong continually in recent decades, even in the nomination process. So that's, you know, the basic parallel, that you need democracy inside a party, as we said when we were picketing outside the latest Democratic National Committee meeting in Chicago. The Democratic Party should live up to its name. And fortunately, because of the grassroots pressure, basically the thumb on the scale from superdelegates in the nomination process has, as of the last couple of weeks, been removed for 2020.
Okay, so some progress was made. I was wondering if you thought that was enough. So what happens now is the superdelegates don't vote in the first round of voting. Is that what it is?
Yes, and there's never been a second round of voting since 1952 when Adlai Stevenson got the nomination. So it's a big improvement. It's not enough. There's a lot more to be done to democratize the Democratic Party. But it's in a very important step, because the 2020 election will proceed without anybody having a head start. You know, Hillary Clinton had half of the delegates 3 months before the first ballot was cast at a primary or caucus a couple of years ago. So this is an important step. But we got a long way to go. And I should say, as bad as the National Democratic Party is in terms of internal democracy, it's worse than the California Democratic Party. It's far worse.
Really?
And it's been rigged up so that Democrats in the state Senate and state assembly can handpick a lot of those who make basic choices inside the party.
Oh, that's really interesting. That might be another autopsy that needs to happen.
Yeah, really.
So you did do, and you call it the autopsy of the 2016 election, on the shortcomings of the Democratic Party. And as I was saying at the top of the hour, you can blame Comey, you can blame the Russians, you can blame gerrymandering, and maybe we'll get into a little of that. But mostly there was a whole lot of things that the party itself could have been doing to ensure victory, which they were not. And so do you want to talk a little bit about the analysts you work with and what this autopsy, what you call it, what does it mean?
Yes, well, traditionally, after the National Party loses the presidential race, there is some, I don't know if soul-searching is the right term, I don't know if a political party has a soul, you know, I won't get theological here, but the reality is that usually there's something done that's called an autopsy. But the Democratic Party, after the disaster of 2016, didn't do one. And so my colleagues and I at RootsAction.org realized that if it was going to be done, it would have to be done independently. So a task force spent a lot of time summer last year pulling together an autopsy, which we released in October of 2017. And a key person on that was Karen Bernal, who is chair of the Progressive Caucus of the California Democratic Party, arguably, by most measures, the largest caucus inside the California party of this state. And so Karen Bernal is a great progressive leader. She's spoken up in the North Coast and all over the country, all over the state, really, about these key issues of democracy in the party and the vast number of realms that we need change in politically in this country. And also Pia Gallegos, who is now the interim chair of the Adelante Progressive Caucus of the New Mexico Democratic Party. I, as well, was on the task force. Sam McCann, who's a human rights activist and has recently become a researcher for the filmmaker Michael Moore. And the result is we published something that everybody is welcome to take a look at on the web. It is formally titled Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis, and online at democraticautopsy.org. And we basically looked at how the party has functioned. And we looked at seven categories, and in those categories we found so many problems where the rhetoric of being for the working class and for people who aren't big money interests was belied by such closeness to Wall Street, to corporate power, which goes, Annie, I think, to the question you're raising of what happened, what's gone wrong, 2016, losing this election. You can't have a bogus pseudo champion of working people so close to Wall Street as Hillary Clinton has been and be convincing. And so that's been a big problem that the autopsy assessed in terms of corporate power, wielding so much leverage over the Democratic Party, rhetorically fighting racism and yet putting so much resources into other avenues, very little resources going to fighting voting suppression. That's what we found a year ago in the Democratic Party. The youth vote. Young people falling away from enthusiasm because of, frankly, the phoniness of claiming to be for working people, getting the big corporate checks, corporate power dominating the party. Well, young people overwhelmingly voted for Bernie Sanders in this state and in the country, in the primaries and caucuses, and there was a huge fall off of young people's support during the actual November election against Donald Trump. And in these and other areas, the bottom line was that when you close off a genuine progressive avenue for electoral expression, as the Democratic Party did for the general election a couple of years ago, the only other avenue for the populism to really express itself is the bogus right-wing, xenophobic, horrific, nativist, misogynist kind of pseudo-populism that the Republican Party represents and that Donald Trump symbolizes.
Yeah, I wonder if you see any difference between the corporate, maybe we could start with the big corporate interest in your autopsy. You have a lot of important separate categories. So basically, are the Democrats different from the Republicans when it comes to Wall Street?
Well, I think we can look at it from several vantage points. For instance, the Supreme Court, which of course ruled on Citizens United and subsequent ruling as well to enshrine this ridiculous but such dangerous concept as personhood for corporations that have all of the rights and none of the real liabilities of individuals. And that came through the Supreme Court. And so I think just looking at it, let's say if you have Sotomayor or Ginsburg appointed by Democrat president, then you have now the most recently, you have Gorsuch on the court because of a Trump nomination. You have Kavanaugh, who's on the verge of, hopefully not, but quite likely being approved by the Senate. Is there a difference between, say, Sotomayor and Ginsburg on the one hand, or Gorsuch and Kavanaugh? And I think we have to say yes. It doesn't mean that I'm thrilled with the judges that Democrats have put on the high court, but I think the reality is there has been, in civil rights issues, in corporate power issues, in environmental issues, in basic democratic, lowercase d issues, yeah, there's a real difference. That said, the Democratic Party has been enmeshed with Wall Street, and you have people like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Party leaders in the Senate and House, just throwing their arms open, figuratively speaking, to embrace Wall Street again and again, and the checks rolling through, and the failure to serve working people, like we say in the autopsy. It's ridiculous to claim that you're going to serve Wall Street and Main Street at the same time. And when we go through our cities and towns, we see the decimation, literally, of our main streets, of our communities. This country is being ravaged by corporate power, and the only way to push back is to galvanize grassroots movements that include electoral work. And some people say, oh, I'm not interested in elections. And I think that's wrong. People have a prerogative to not be interested, but social movements need to include electoral work. Whether you're in New York or San Francisco or Ukiah, you've got to look at who is on the city council, who's being elected to other local offices, to the state legislature, and to the National Congress and the presidency. That's having a huge effect on our lives.
You said something about the Democrats were trying to have it both ways, like Clinton was working for Main Street and Wall Street, and the gap in between was just the gap that Trump needed to insert his message. So there's a lot of people that think that Trump's just a regular guy.
Huh. Yes, it's the, you know what they say, sincerity isn't hard if you're good at faking it. And, of course, it. You know, the old Jerzy Kaczynski novel, which was made into a film starring Peter Sellers, Being There, was a plot of somebody who grew up watching TV and was able to mimic what looked like TV reality, and unfortunately sort of foreshadowed the Trump phenomenon. And I think sometimes something that's a symptom becomes a cause as well. So I certainly agree that Trump is a symptom of corporate capitalism, which is really antithetical to democracy. When you have big money interests, corporations that have no accountability whatsoever to any really democratic process where it's really $1, one vote, then that is antithetical to people power where it is one person, one vote, and democracy can flourish. And at the same time, when because of this corporate power you get such an extreme servant of Wall Street and the fossil fuel industry and the banking sector, as Donald Trump in power and with all of the hacks for plutocracy, for autocracy, as are in the cabinet posts and so forth, that accentuates and accelerates the problem in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. Let's return for a moment to the youth vote that you mentioned. In the 2016 primaries, it was very high, and then you said it dropped off for the final election in November of that year. I hadn't heard that, or I don't remember hearing that, so I didn't know it was actually measurable that way. So what do you think of that for this year regarding the primaries so far?
Well, I think it's a hazard. However, despite the very restrictive election rules where you can't switch parties so you can vote in a Democratic primary in less than 6 months in New York, just last night the election returns, while Cynthia Nixon did not win and the great candidate for Attorney General fell short, Zephyr Teachout, there were some very important developments where close to half a dozen of the phony corporate Democrats in the state Senate were toppled. And so you've got, and really a new one as well, a progressive candidate winning. So you've got half a dozen in a very tightly contested, sort of razor-thin margin in the state Senate in New York. It's going over to a progressive direction because of these victories, and the youth vote has been crucial. You have candidates who were young themselves, one of them in New York City under 30, galvanizing the youth vote. And I think that we saw that a few months ago in the congressional primary in New York, where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, 28 years old, not only young herself, but drew in many first-time voters or infrequent voters who were young to topple the fourth most powerful Democrat in the U.S. House, Joe Crowley, and she's an avowed Democratic socialist. We've had other young people running and energizing as volunteers and campaign workers around the country. I think this does have, some reasons for optimism, but it needs to go to programs as well. For instance, in the North Bay, North Coast, we have so many people, as around the country, who are even not finding that they can go to or stay in junior colleges because it's costing them money. They should have free public college. This is something that Bernie Sanders ran on. And it's not just running young candidates. Bernie was the oldest candidate running for the Democratic nomination, but he had a youth-affirming program, including free public college, and that's where we need to go.
Yeah, you put it very well when you say in your writing that you're not just to encourage voter turnout, you need to energize it. And that's more or less what happened under Obama's first run. People were energized, and with the young people and Sanders, and a lot of old people, too. But the Democratic Party isn't, like, known for keying in on that, and Hillary, who had the upper hand in the Sanders-Clinton race for the nomination, she certainly soft-pedaled all of those things that Bernie was suggesting. She took those suggested programs and kind of made kind of mud out of them. Do you want to talk a little bit about the difference between the way Sanders or these new progressive socialists, Democrats that are showing up, thank goodness, the way they propose the program and then the way the entrenched Democrat would frame a program like health care, for example?
Yes, it's very important. I mean, in effect, Hillary Clinton as the party nominee de-energized the party, and certainly including young people. As a matter of fact, it was so bad, just to digress briefly here, I wrote a piece for the Hill newspaper a few weeks after the 2016 Democratic Convention, and I cited the latest authoritative poll, and I said at that point, if the 18 to 29 voting cohort could determine who the next president would be, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian Party candidate, would beat Hillary Clinton if it was down to those two. He was polling higher. And a lot of that, that was among young people. There was such a fall off in enthusiasm for her. Now, I think it's notable to say that what goes by libertarian in this country and Libertarian Party and so forth is usually code word for let corporations run everything. It's a weird use in this country of the word libertarian. To me, slavery under corporate power is not being in a liberty situation. But that aside, I think your key question here is very important. Bernie put forward a vision of democratic socialism. The word socialism wasn't the point. The reality of saying that there are basic human rights, health care is a human right, education, housing, neonatal care, taking care of children, taking care of the elderly. These aren't privileges. These are what should be, in the spirit of the New Deal and carrying it forward, human rights. And the vision that the perspective put forward by the Hillary Clinton forces in the party, those perspectives were really quite different. When you scrape off the shiny rhetoric, you get this sort of rusty underneath, which is we're going to tinker. And I think it was symbolized by when some propagandist specialist with the Trump campaign early on came up with the slogan, Make America Great Again. Hillary Clinton's and Obama as well, speaking for Clinton, their response was, America's already great. Well, can you think of a more status quo complacent slogan than America's already great? And I hate to think what the consultants were paid to come up with that one, but it really epitomizes, you know, you drive from the Golden Gate Bridge to the Oregon border along the coast, and you see in communities large and small the desperation that many people feel financially. And the news media, corporate news media and NPR news and so forth, they will tell us ongoing that the economy is getting better in recent years. And yet it's sort of a thing like, who you going to believe, the news media or your own eyes? Income inequality continues to grow. People who have spent out their savings, who've gone into debt, whose children are not, as in the past, doing better financially than their parents' generation, but doing worse. And this is the contradiction that we need to confront.
Yeah, that's amazing, because I really would jump up and down when I would hear Sanders talk about education programs, and then Clinton, how different they were. One was like so soft. And the other thing that you just touched on a little while ago that I think you've done a lot of work on is racial issues in the context of the Democratic Party. Obama, the first black president, I mean, that really energized, there's that word again, a lot of people. But then the black vote has since fallen off abruptly. What's going on there?
Yes, and the autopsy cites some data that, as I remember, 6 or 7% fall off in black vote for Hillary Clinton 2 years ago compared to Obama. And people would say, well, that's because Obama's black. Well, the party needed to put even more energy towards reaching out. There's a lot of ads that were done that were not, and this is true of Latino voters as well, that were not addressing the concerns or the communities of people of color. And the Democratic Party said, you know, we can take them for granted. We've got the black and Latino vote in the bag. Let's go elsewhere. And as a matter of fact, the current chair of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez, is somebody who was put in as a Hillary Clinton supporter. He barely was elected after the 2016 election to head the DNC. And he made a statement a couple of months ago. He said, we took people of color for granted. We were wrong. I'm sorry. We're not going to do it again. And as the saying goes, the first step towards correcting a problem is to acknowledge that it exists. And so, you know, we'll see. But I think that through losing and through, frankly, grassroots pressure, there has been, at the top, a forced recognition that things have got to change in a more progressive direction. I think that's reflected in the superdelegate decision to democratize the process of choosing the nominee. And it just goes deeper in terms of dealing with fighting institutionalized racism in this country, including police violence. It's not enough to use the slogans. It's not enough to put black and Latino and Asian American faces on the stage at the national convention, which the Democratic Party did. Nobody can say, and I say this as a Bernie Sanders delegate from our congressional district, nobody can say there weren't a lot of people of color on the stage at the convention. But the program wasn't there, the outreach wasn't there, and the respect that involves community communication 24/7, 365 in decimated, poor, and often people of color communities, that hasn't been there from the party either, and that has to change.
So tell us more about what you mentioned a minute ago about how much more democratized or not the process is or will be in the future for selecting candidates then inside the party?
Well, there was a huge problem. I use the analogy of the last presidential race where, let's say, you have two contestants at the starting line and the gun goes off, and the instant the gun goes off, one of the runners is way ahead. And that's what happened. Because of superdelegates, if you were watching CNN or another one of the cable news shows 3 years ago, this would have been the late summer, early fall of 2015, you would have seen Hillary Clinton way ahead in the race for the nomination among delegates. Well, nobody had voted yet. The way she was way ahead was that 370 of the superdelegates had already declared their intention to vote on the floor of the convention for Hillary Clinton, and three or four or five had declared they were going to do that for Bernie. Well, why is that? Because members of Congress are among the superdelegates, and they're, by almost definition, establishment people. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, Jared Huffman was one of those superdelegates, just way ahead of time, because they thought Hillary Clinton was going to be president, and they didn't want her to be angry at them for not backing her from the get-go. Mm-hmm. On the contrary, they wanted to be in her favor. So they were all behind her, and that, from the beginning, really skewed the race, because Hillary Clinton was the front runner. She got that media label. She was able to leverage that for fundraising purposes. It was all perception that she was ahead from the start. And that won't be the case for the 2020 race because the essentially superdelegates will be bystanders for the decisive first ballot. So I think that's important, but there are other things as well. Financial transparency has been a mess at the DNC, the ruling body, the Democratic Party. That has to change. We've got many state primaries where the registration or the ability to change registration is so far away from the election day that people don't have a chance to participate. That's particularly true of young people who have been alienated. So I'd say there's one other thing that comes to mind offhand which is related. During her book tour after her loss, her book called What Happened, is certainly what happened from her perspective, Hillary Clinton gave TV interviews, and I saw one of them online. She said, and Bernie Sanders, he's not even a Democrat. If he's not going to be a Democrat, why is he running for nomination in our party? And I think that epitomizes, you know, Steve and Annie, when I think of what sort of symbolizes the dysfunction and the ridiculous clubhouse attitude of the Democratic Party leadership, that about sums it up. When you look at the statistics, more people by far in this country are independent in their registration. In this state, it's called decline to state, but whatever you call it, there are far more, it's close to 2-to-1 ratio, are independents rather than registered Democrats. And that you have, at the same time, you've got Democratic Party leaders like Hillary Clinton basically trashing people for not being a Democrat. You know, it reminds me of the old cartoons of like the clubhouse, you know, no girls allowed. I mean, it's ridiculous. When you run a political party like a clubhouse, like a club, it's exclusionary. We should be welcoming in anybody and everybody who shares progressive values into the party voting for party nominees.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, we're speaking with Norman Solomon, well-known American journalist, author, and media critic, discussing issues in the Democratic Party and some parallels with the infamous time of 1968 when the convention in Chicago was so raucous. And if anyone would like to call in with any questions and join the conversation, the number here is 895-2448. Again, 895-2448. It's area code 707.
The right has a frightening field of voter suppression projects, in particular attacking voting rights of people of color who are presumed to be Democrats often. What is the Democratic Party doing to make sure that people are not disenfranchised like that on this huge scale?
Well, until recently, not much. In the autopsy, we noted that in May of 2017, with a great drum roll, the DNC announced that they were going to have 4 full-time people working on voter suppression rather than 1. Can you imagine, in the midst of an immediate aftermath of the 2016 voter suppression election, the National Committee of the Democratic Party had a grand total of 1 person on the staff who was working on voter suppression.
That is a
surprise. In fact, we have so many states under the control of Republican legislatures that have instituted draconian voter suppression measures requiring voter IDs, ways to intimidate people of color, those who are immigrants. And it's paid off for the Republican Party. It has to be fought tooth and nail. The Democratic Party seems to be belatedly but seriously gearing up to fight the kind of voter suppression that still exists.
Okay, better late than never. We do have a call on the line. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, Dorothea Dorman calling. Our last two presidents have been notoriously unfaithful to their wives, and Trump even to the point of buying these expensive cover-ups and using his lawyer to pay bribes to shut the women up. I mean, isn't this an indicator that our electoral system is in deep trouble? Because this violates the principles of almost all religions, like the Muslim allows polygamy for the men.
Okay.
It seems like our electoral system is totally disenfranchised from the people. I want to hear what you have to say about that.
Thanks for your call, Dorothea. So, yeah, it is sort of funny because this is a religious right that is putting forth these strange candidates.
Well, I mean, in terms of Trump, it shows, and it's even the secular right wing, they know Trump is, you know, a pathological liar, but he's the boat that they want to put their cargo in, and he's delivering the goods. You know, the Supreme Court nominees is a case in point. And same thing with the seemingly pious religious evangelical right wing. They also know that, you know, Trump is no, even by their definition, no Christian, but he's delivering the goods, putting on the Supreme Court people who want to decimate a woman's right to choose, for instance. This is, sort of a Faustian bargain that's been made. In terms of the call, I think the caller said the last two presidents. I'm not aware of any allegations of marital infidelity among Obama, but you know, more to the point, let's face it, there could be presidents who are completely, they could be celibate, they could be completely faithful to their spouse, and they could be mass murderers, you know, and the inverse. I just think, let's get real about what we want from presidents. We want ones that respond to the public, who work for the well-being of humanity, and that's what the policies need to be.
Hi, we have another call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for Annie and Norman and crew to be there for all of us to consider, because I'm really upset about there is no presence of the Democratic Party in the public. I don't know where the meetings are. If I wanted to participate, how could you do it? I'm a Christian, Buddhist, Gaia, Great Spirit follower, peacenik, you know, active in the civil rights movement very, very thoroughly, and continue to be active in the community. But there's no way to participate if there is no visual. And I want to know, where's the impeachment movement? Because it's absolutely ridiculous that this man should continue to be at the helm, purportedly representing anybody. You know, I mean, he's a fascist. It's dictatorship. I have a friend who said that we live in a critocracy. And I had not heard that word before. It means rule by the judges.
Okay, let's see if Norman has a reaction to that.
The Supreme Court being, Obama was denied his ability and his right as a public servant to appoint someone to the Supreme Court for 8 years. And here's this fascist man coming in and appointing people to take over the third of the government.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you, and Norman can have a chance to respond. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you, and I think I'm getting two questions there. The first one, I think, is a great point. Where is the Democratic Party in our communities? I mean, at most, right before the election, there's some campaign headquarters set up. But there's no visibility 24/7. There's no visibility in our communities. And I think that's a very important point. This isn't just election time stuff. This should be a Democratic Party present in communities, pushing for and defending human rights in all sorts of realms, so that it's a party that's participatory. And frankly, that's not what the party has been about. It's not what the leadership has been about. You look at, and I don't need to go outside of our region to be, I think, clear about it. You have people whose purpose is to get elected who have any background in support from or for social movements. So then you end up in the assembly with somebody like Jim Wood, who's irresponsible, who's a corporate tool, and that is just reality. I mean, he might be a very nice person, but that's not the point. It's not a personal thing. It's about what interests are served. Is it the big landowners and agribusiness, or is it environmental protection and farm workers? And when you have people who are not accountable to communities, it's much easier for them to not be accountable when the party that they represent that they identify with. That
I want to ask about the 21 trillion
visibility in the communities and doesn't have a presence where people can participate.
You know, I'm sorry. I had another caller on the line, and I pick up the calls for you people that are calling in. I pick up the call before I'm going to ask you to speak, but that's because I don't want you to drop off because the phone company cuts you off after a certain time. But then when I pick up your call and you hear Norman talking or you hear us talking, you have to be very quiet until I say, hello, caller, you're on the air. Otherwise, I'm going to drop you because you'd be talking over Norman, okay? So we have a call right now. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I want to know, what's the story with the $21 trillion that the military can't find? It's lost. I've been seeing this online, and that's a heck of a lot of money, $21 trillion. If I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you so much.
Well,
yeah, that's an important thing.
I don't think it could possibly be $21 trillion. I think it might be $21 billion, but I'm not familiar with that story. You know, in general, I mean, the accountability of the Pentagon for money is almost non-existent. And after the invasion of Iraq, we had, you know, millions and millions of dollars, I think, into the billions that ultimately could not be accounted for. And, you know, that's what happened. You got suitcases of cash being flown around. But more broadly, you got more than half of the discretionary budget in this country going to the military. This is a war-crazed economy. It's a war-crazed country. The military-industrial surveillance intelligence complex absorbs huge amounts of dollars. This is a theft from children. If you don't want to listen to a progressive Democrat, listen to a mainline Republican named Dwight Eisenhower, who said, every bullet, every bomb, every tank is in reality a theft from the children of the world. This theft is going on in the North Bay and North Coast around this country and around the planet. The ongoing militarism of this country is a crime against humanity of massive proportions. And you have the Democratic Party basically in lockstep with the Republican Party. This is one of the worst aspects of what is going on from the so-called leadership of the Democratic Party. And I was very pleased to be one of the hundreds of delegates at the Democratic National Convention in 2016 when we were hearing speeches broadcast nationally from people like Leon Panetta calling for more war, glorifying perpetual war. When we chanted no more war, we were expressing what so many people feel in this country. And this is a battle yet to be fought. You know, I believe that our two senators, our congressperson that represent us in this district, they are irresponsible in failing to confront the warfare state, and we've got to demand that they do so.
That's a major part of your autopsy elements is the whole issue of the how hawkish the government, Clinton was compared to Sanders. We have another call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I am on the Mendocino Democratic Central Committee, and I heard on the radio the guy saying that Democrats are not visible in the county. First of all, the website is mendodems.org, M-E-N-D-O-Dems.org, and the headquarters for the campaign is on State Street in Ukiah, at, right next door to Big O, and we just had a big picnic in the park on Labor Day, featuring representatives from labor. So to say that the Democratic Party is not visible in the county, perhaps people should take a look on the Internet and check it out. So that's all I got to say.
Thank you. Thanks for that.
Thank you for your comments, and I'm glad that that work is going on. If the Mendocino County Democratic Party has a headquarters functioning throughout the year, whether it's an odd-numbered year or even-numbered year, which I doubt, it would be very unusual, extremely unusual. That's rare in this state or in this country to be an ongoing. It's usually episodic, it's sporadic, it's before an election, it's during an election campaign. And what it says to people, it's like the old Stevie Wonder song.
Wait, hold on a second. Yeah, the headquarters is specifically set up to run the campaign, but yeah, there are Democratic clubs that meet every month in down in Gualala, in Fort Bragg, in Ukiah, and the Central Committee meets every month as well.
Great. So where is the headquarters that's open every week of every year?
There's not a headquarters open every week every year, but there are the clubs that meet every month.
For the people on the inside and the in crowd who know where to go and have that motivation. But why can't we have a Democratic Party with one headquarters that's open every week, every year?
Let me come on that. I do know there's an expense associated with that, which is more than the party can afford locally every year round.
Community support, it's like saying you can't have a candidate for president who's viable without Wall Street support. If you
Wait a minute. Look, we have the clubs meet every single month. The meetings are posted on the internet, the dates and the times, and the Central Committee meets every month. And if you want to get involved in the Democratic Party, come to the meetings and get involved. You don't have people, who's going to pay for somebody to sit in some office somewhere 7 days a week or 5 days a week. The clubs meet, the clubs are the active part of the Democratic Party. That's how it works.
Go ahead.
That's just how it works.
Yes, it's the way it works with an elitist party. I don't understand.
It is not elitist. It's not elitist. Everybody is welcome. Everybody can come. The meetings are posted online, where they are, when they are, and it's not elitist. Anybody who wants to come is welcome to come, and it's open to everybody who thinks they want to get involved. It's not elitist.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
The question is, respect what you're saying. I respect what you're doing. My point is that if you really want to do community outreach that's ongoing and not episodic, you have a location, you have an office where people can go if they have problems meeting their rent, if they're being treated unfair in the workplace, if they have environmental concerns, if they want to organize neighborhood by neighborhood. They know where they can go, not just during election season. Our lives don't only exist during the elections. They exist 24/7, 365. And if we had a really healthy party, we'd be able to open an office and keep it open all the time.
I know the Inland Democrats, they meet at the bowling alley, right?
They have been for the last year or so, but there is an office now.
What's happening to the public sector is we're being pushed to the margins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How many public spaces are they? It's a metaphor for the New Deal. We're being told we've got to scurry around and find little places where we can meet rather than, we have, how many banks are there in the county? There's huge numbers of banks. We know where we can go to help Bank of America or Wells Fargo enrich their profits. We don't have one place where we know we can go for a political party that's supposed to represent our interests and meet with people and organize.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting close to out of time, and I appreciate the Democratic person that called in, and I appreciate the discussion that you had about that, Norman. You've got to have a base all the time. But there's so many more elements that you have in this autopsy, and we're about out of time. You touched on the issue of the hawkish stand of Clinton and what that a problem is, that most of the people in the party, the loudest voices were anti-war rather than interventionist. And one other element that maybe we have time to get into, which I thought was really interesting, is you talk about the relationship between social movements and political parties. So what is the problem with the Democratic Party there?
Well, you can't really embrace social movements if you're afraid of social movements. And I think it's fair to say that the top of the Democratic Party, with few exceptions, has seen social movements as something to keep at bay. And that's not a healthy relationship. I think that has begun to change, frankly, when you have people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez winning elections, and it's understood that the wave of enthusiasm from younger people, from people of color, from strong progressives, is putting people in power. And so, there's perhaps two kinds of fear. One is a fear that says, we're going to keep the gates locked. And the other is, we better let you in because you have so much power. And I think the ascendancy of progressives from the grassroots is creating the second kind of fear. And so I do see progress in that way in the last year.
Okay, then another thing, at the end of the autopsy, you talk a little bit about the future and what has to be done to survive.
Well, I think it's a synthesis. I mean, there's a lot of truths. A lot of people are doing good work, I assume, including our last caller. It's not easy to organize as Democratic Party activists and officials and so forth. But what needs to be done is to broaden it out to realize the dysfunction that serves corporate power that passes for democracy in this country. We have such an absence of democracy. We have the dominance of big money to such an extent that we have to consciously structure our activities to counter that. And that means not telling people in disenfranchised, discriminated against, disadvantaged communities, well, you can find us. We need to reach out to them, listen to them. How can we help them? How can we provide resources, services, and broader structures that truly are participatory, and that we listen? We don't just tell them how they can find us if they can figure out how to find us. So many people are working two jobs. They're in disadvantaged circumstances. We need to realize there's a class conflict going on here. There's corporate power versus people power, and we've got to be clear which side we're on.
So this 2016 election autopsy that you worked on, it's available online. Of course, it's about 33 pages, but it also has an executive summary. Do you want to just outline that a little bit for people and where they can find it?
Yes, everybody's invited to take a look at it and distribute it. You know, we've had forums around the country, people discussing the conclusions, and you can find it on the web. It's democraticautopsy.org, and I think you find it very readable.
Okay, and there's a few other references I thought I'd mention to listeners. You are involved with the Courage Foundation, and that is at couragefound.org. And then, and you're still involved with Roots Action, I believe.
Yes, and actually, I'd like to encourage people. You know, we have close to 1.5 million people now, and more than 1 million of them in the United States. We're taking action on a wide range of issues, petitions, email campaigns. Sometimes we can deluge one prison official, for instance, with 8,000 or 10,000 individual emails to support a prisoner who is being treated violently by the system. Many different examples against polluting corporations. You can find all of it at rootsaction.org. If you sign up, you'll get those alerts. You'll be part of our action arm together. And again, that's at rootsaction.org.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us. This has been Norman Solomon, our guest for the day, and appreciate you taking calls from listeners. And I'll be staying in touch, as I have for years, so I'd like to follow your work.
Okay, well, thank you, Steve. Thank you, Andy, and thank you, KZ Wyatt.
YX, yeah, mm-hmm. Thank you, Norman. Appreciate it. We'll have to follow up after the next election. Thanks again.
So this has been Corporations and Democracy, broadcast second and fourth Fridays from 11 to 12 noon here on KZYX&Z. The next edition will be in 2 weeks. That's September 28th with host Linda McClure. Annie and I will return on Friday, October 12th at 11 a.m. And for further information about what you can do to correct the corporate dominance of our democracy, go to www.thealliancefordemocracy.org. Thanks for listening.